Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Tapecast. My name is Davis Matic. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I'm joined by Andrew Brokos, who is the host of the Thinking Poker podcast, the owner of Knitcast.com, and also the author of Play Optimal Poker and Play Optimal Poker 2, the second of which just came out this month. So I had Andrew on the show to talk about the first book and the way that Play Optimal Poker 2 builds upon the first book, but also, some introductions to advanced concept. You guys can probably tell that, we've had some more poker-related content on the show over the last couple weeks. I think that I've gotten some good feedback on it. Maria Konnikova's interview was, of course, fantastic. If you haven't listened to that yet, I would definitely go ahead and go back and listen to that if you enjoy this conversation with Andrew. For my money, Andrew is one of the most thoughtful guys that you'll find on the game, and I think that Play Optimal Poker 1, which is on sale right now, and Play Optimal Poker 2 are some of the best poker books that I have ever read. And as an added benefit, right now, if you purchase Andrew's book in the month of June, all of the proceeds are going directly to Give Directly, which is a charity that does exactly what it sounds like, gives money directly to those who are in need. So definitely go ahead and purchase the book. There's a link to do so in the description to this podcast. If you want to support the show, bonus episodes on patreon.com/Tapecast, and of course, a rating and review on iTunes always goes a long way. Now let's go ahead and get into the show with Andrew. All right, everyone, welcoming in Andrew Brokos to the show. He is the author of Play Optimal Poker and Play Optimal Poker 2 Range Construction. You can purchase both of those books on Amazon. You can also get them on Andrew's website, Knitcast.com. Andrew, thank you very much for joining the show. Really excited to talk to you about the books.
Thanks for having me. That's very kind of you.
So for those of you who are maybe not familiar with the Thinking Poker podcast or Play Optimal Poker, they are what is widely considered, if you're on 2+2, if you're on R-Poker or whatever, Andrew's books are pretty widely considered to be the best modern GTO-centric poker books on the market. So I think a great place to start, Andrew, is with this question. What is the most pervasive, non-understanding, misunderstanding about game theory by both the average person and then, if it's different, the average poker player?
I wouldn't even know about the average person.
Yeah.
I've even tried to talk to about game theory. And it is, among poker players, it's hard to choose because there are a lot. But I would say probably the most pervasive and also maybe the most damaging is the belief that game theory is something that is only relevant for kind of high stakes players or people playing in tough games. A variant of this misunderstanding is that it's only relevant for people who are playing with the same players on sort of a very regular basis, where it's like, oh, I don't have to worry about balance unless I'm going to play with this person several hundred times or several thousand times even. I would say the biggest misunderstanding is that it's not for me. It's for those other guys who are better than I am and playing in tougher games. I think it's both extremely pervasive and also, a lot of people are limiting their growth in poker with that belief.
Yeah, I think a common thought would be, this is for Phil Ivey, right? This is for Justin Bonomo. This is for the guys who are playing, 500, 1,000 or whatever. And
for even the guys who are playing 5-10,
5-10.
I think it's relevant for people who are playing 5-cent, 10-cent. I think it's relevant. I mean, if you want to get better at poker, it's relevant for you.
Yeah, I think that is a pretty astute observation. And I certainly think it's an easy trap to fall into, especially because I would, you can be, let's say, what do we think, 50 cent, $1 fast fold poker online, you can probably either beat that or just lose to the rake in that game without focusing super hard on frequency and theory and stuff, playing hand strength and thinking of, what your hand strength is relative to what your opponent's hand strength would be.
Yeah, and a lot of people will say that, like, well, I can beat this game without game theory. You can. But poker is not like a binary, you either win or you lose. Like, it matters how much you win by. you can win more in the game that you're currently playing if you understand theory. You might even be in a position to move up in stakes if you get to the point where you better understand theory. Like you're going to make better decisions. You're going to win more money. And I mean, if you're content with where you are in poker, you're just like, I'm perfectly happy. Well, even that might not be good enough actually, because if other people are getting better and you're stagnating, but regardless, you know, if you're sort of content with what you're doing, fine. But you know, if you want to get better, but, you know, this is how people get better at the game. It's how people get better at every game. I mean, if you're studying backgammon or you're studying chess, you'd be working with a computer, or at least you'd be learning strategy things that are, you know, derived from, even if you're not the one doing the work, or you're sort of getting it downstream from people who are doing work with computers. That's just how people learn games.
Which is not how things were during the poker boom, right? So from Moneymaker to Black Friday, well, I mean, maybe you can correct this, but most, like, solvers did not exist before. Well, when did the first solver, you know, come into, like, outside of, you know, literally guys who built the solver themselves on their computers? Like at what point do solvers enter the game, at large?
They probably came onto my radar maybe 2014, somewhere in that neighborhood. I imagine they were around a little before that. But you know, that's not the only way that people have used computers to study. I mean, equity calculators have been around for a long time. We interviewed Andy Block on our show, and he was talking about doing some very early, like, game theory work with computers, even in like the early 2000s, maybe even in the 90s. I forget the exact details, but you know, the solver is just sort of the most recent. I don't even know. I started to say Apex, but I don't know if that's true. We don't know yet. But it is the most recent iteration. And the most powerful iteration of how computers can help us better investigate the game of poker. But you know, for basically probably as long as you know, computers have been around, people who understood computers and understood poker had the thought, hey, that thing could probably help me with this thing.
So I think there are maybe not a lot of people, you know, maybe not millions of people, but I think there are a fair amount of people who, like me, you know, stopped following poker seriously after Black Friday, you know, for a lot of different reasons. Like, it was harder to play. You know, it was disillusioning. A lot of the people that we thought we liked, you know, Howard Lederer and Ferguson and all those guys were involved in, you know, dealings that certainly were not entirely above board. So there were a lot of reasons why poker became different after Black Friday. But a lot of us are picking the game back up now after some time off, you know, watching some of these super high roller events that are taking place online, you know, getting Poker Go subscriptions. And I'm just kind of wondering, from someone who did not, you know, really take that much time off, what has been the influence of the solver era on No Limit Hold'em? You know, how has the game really changed from, you know, five betting and six betting with every possible hand in 2010, you know, to how high-level players are thinking and playing the game now?
That's a big...
Yeah, that's a big question.
A lot of time answering
very
that
big question.
I mean, I think most fundamentally, it's shaken up some things that we thought we knew about poker. Things, I mean, maybe some people never bought into these things or had some hunch that they were wrong, but there are some pretty solidly, like, received wisdom in poker that solvers can show us definitively are wrong. I think a good example of this is the continuation bet. I mean, people read Harrington on Hold'em way back when, and you sort of, I don't even know that he really says this in the book, but a lot of people come away from that with the impression of, well, if I raise pre-flop, I'm probably going to bet the flop. And there's a lot of nuance that goes into that, but I mean, we can definitively show, like, no doubt about it, with a solver, that is, I mean, it's possible if your opponent is making the right kinds of mistakes that that's going to be profitable, but there are plenty of situations where, you know, simply being the preflop raiser, even a heads up pot, does not, like, entitle you to a profitable bet. That, you know, it is going to be very far from the optimal strategy, most likely even against weaker opposition, right? Let alone, I'm not just talking about in tough games, just in general, no matter how weak your opponents are, it's unlikely that the very best strategy is, if you raise preflop and you get a heads up on the flop, you should just continuation bet 100% without regard for anything else, positions, board texture, what your hand is. That's just not true. And I think that there's a number of other received wisdoms along that line. There are situations where your C bet percent is zero. I mean, it's that dramatic of a difference, where, like, you should actually, the best play would be for you to never bet. And I think there are people who think that, you know, they should always bet in those cases. So, I mean, there have been really dramatic shakeups along those lines. And then I think it's also accelerated or facilitated a trend that was already in progress, which was people thinking in terms of ranges rather than just trying to like guess what they thought their opponent was going to do, which I think when you mentioned like 5, 6, 7 betting, right, that's sort of the epitome of the opposite of that, where people were just sort of like, oh, well, you know, he made that 6 bet, but it's a really good spot for him to 6 bet light. So I'm just going to shove with, you know, do 7 offsuit to take the extreme, like Vanessa Self's example. But, you know, and that's literally just guessing. Like, that's trying to guess that your opponent is going to fold too often to a shove. And some of those people might have been right. I mean, arguably Vanessa Self was very good at making those kinds of guesses. But nowadays, there's not even, it's likely that there wouldn't even be the opportunity to make that guess, right? The people's ranges for like making a 4-bet, like, people know how to construct that range well enough that it's simply not going to be profitable to shove with any 2-bet. I mean, people aren't guessing at what their like 4 and 5 betting ranges should be, nor are they guessing at what their flop check raising range should be. By people, I mean like people who have done a little bit of study with through game theory, not necessarily with the solver, but you know, at least studied with people who have studied the solvers. You know, there's not a lot of like any two cards kind of spots that people used to talk about it in, you know, 2005, 2006. Oh, you just bet here with any two cards. There aren't really spots like that anymore. And when you're playing with like reasonably competent opponents, because people know, even, and I'm not saying they're getting their range constructions perfectly or that there's no opportunity for exploitation, but there aren't those like huge gaps where it's just a matter of guessing like, oh, this person is probably just, you know, super light in this situation. The better you understand game theory, the more guesswork falls out of poker.
Right, yeah, because ranges tend to not be random, especially amongst people who, you know what they're doing. One of the other big things that has been different in terms of how people talk about poker and how people play is people call a lot more. And this, they talk about this in The Mathematics of Poker, which Playing Cards Face Up, I have not read, but I have read Poker's 1%, which is Ed Miller's book. That's kind of like the, if you're not really, really good at math, this is how to understand the concepts in that book. And the idea, Ed Miller's idea of like the pyramid, right? Of like you should be playing, you know, like roughly, you know, this many cards past the flop, this many cards past the turn, and this many cards you're calling down at the river. Like the idea, and maybe this is no longer true from the time that Ed wrote this book, that that we should sort of roughly be continuing from the turn with about 70% of our hands in terms of a calling range. But like it used to, like in 2005, 2008, whatever, like being a calling station was bad. Like calling a lot was viewed as like weak play or whatever. And then, you know, it seems that the solvers a lot of the times actually do think that, you know, calling with gut shots and things like that are, you know, well within the game tree.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think a really good example of this is calling from the big blind in tournaments. I mean, people who have played tournaments will, I think, almost certainly appreciate that. And I remember reading Gus Hansen's book, Every Hand Revealed, which is maybe 2009 or something. I mean, that was a book that's, you know, 10 plus years old now. And I remember he was doing, I mean, he was calling a lot of hands from the big blind. And I remember thinking at the time, like, this is crazy. Or like, he must be like super elite at poker to be able to make this stuff profitable, like calling a raise with King 6 offsuit from the big blind. Who would do that? And you know, now it's well understood that you should do that. And part of it is the solvers kind of demonstrating that it is profitable, but part of it also is just like better understanding post-flop play so that, because I think the idea used to be like everyone recognized that you had enough equity to call with King 6. If you just looked at your immediate pot odds and you're getting like 4-1, like, yeah, King 6 has 20% equity against whatever the person's opening range is. But you know, people are sort of, well, it's too hard to play out of position. The disadvantage of being out of position with such a bad hand, you're not going to, you know, you're going to make bigger mistakes and you should just cut your losses and fold. That was my, and so the better that you understand how to handle the sort of like thorny post-flop situations, as you say, like, what if my opponent keeps betting? What if he doesn't keep betting? What if, you know, what if I flop a gut shot? The better that you like have a solid answer to those questions, which understanding theory can help you to do, then you make those calls profitably. Like a solver can show you this is a very profitable call as long as you play, it doesn't have to be perfect, but like as long as you play reasonably well after the flop. And that is a big, but I mean, some people are not going to play that hand reasonably well after.
Yeah, some people will just be donking money off if they're calling King 6 off in the big blind.
Yeah, and so like as a crutch, you know, folding that into saying like, well, I'm not good enough to do this. I mean, that it's better than calling and spewing money off. But you know, ideally, you get good enough to do it. It's not the hardest part of poker to sort of learn how to handle these like tricky out of position spots. And I think a lot of people's approach to poker has more to do with like when I'm coaching people, one of the big things that I'm trying to shift people's mindset is away from, you know, how do I avoid getting into difficult situations myself? You know, like, oh, I might have a hard decision later if I do this now, so I just won't do
yeah.
it. Or it would be easier for me if I just bet my opponent folds, now I won't have tough decisions later, so I'll just do that. And so you shift away from, you know, running away from tough decisions yourself and towards trying to present your opponent with tough decisions. And part of the reason why you're willing to lean into tough decisions yourself is that you know how to handle them reasonably well. And again, the point isn't that you handle them perfectly. You don't have to get them exactly right. You just have to be able to handle them reasonably well. And that's one of the things that I've found theory most useful for, you know, especially when I'm playing against a competition that I know is tough, or even people that I know are likely better than I am at poker, that I'm like, okay, I'm not going to make a huge mistake. Like whoever, even if I'm playing against Phil Ivey, like I'm confident that I'm not going to make huge mistakes in those situations. I'm not saying I'm going to have an edge on him, but like, I think that I can play well enough that he's not going to have a huge edge on me. I'm not going to play him heads up, but you know, if there were a good game that was like, I'm better than five or six people at this table, but then like two or three of them are better than I am, you know, I'm going to be okay with that because I feel like I'm not going to lose that much to the two or three who are better than I am. I can sort of hold my own against them at least. And then, you know, as long as the five or six are like sufficiently bad enough, like I'll get my share of the profits from those players. And that's how I try to present game theory to people, you know, especially if you're going to, you know, there are a lot of sort of what I call weekend warriors, the kind of like recreational players who they have a game that they play in somewhat regularly and they're pretty comfortable there. They play there, you know, 2-5 at the local casino or whatever. But then like a couple times a year, the WPT comes through their town or the WSAP circuit comes through and they play. And now there's all these like traveling pros and these people's heads are spinning because like, oh, these people are doing, you know, these guys are doing stuff I've never seen before. And I don't know how to play again. And so I think that's one of the many ways that game theory is useful, is it just, it enables you to hold your own against people who are better than you and doing things that you're not used to seeing. You know, it enables you to kind of think on your feet and figure out a reasonably good strategy on the fly.
So I think there's also sort of like a mental salve, like when we're talking about difficult spots, which is the idea of frequencies. So you put a hand into a solver, you're thinking about things from a game theory perspective, there's a chance, like, I mean, there's a very solid chance that oftentimes calling, folding, and raising are all going to be recommended by a computer that understands EV better than you are, you know, at some frequency. And that is, to me, one of the, maybe this is not a good takeaway, but to me, it's sort of you know, a mental pathway to thinking about difficult situations that doesn't make you feel like you're playing so terribly, you know, even if you lose the hand or end up making a decision against your opponent's range that ends up being non-profitable or non-EV, which is just the idea that, you know, there's a difference between I call 45% of the time, right? And understanding that you're not always like going to be making the right play, but because it's balanced, it's actually over a million hands or whatever, you know, the correct decision. I think I'm babbling right now, but just sort of the idea, I guess the idea that you can make a play that's incorrect in the hand you're playing, but in the theoretical elements of the hand of the difficult situation, it's not that bad because it should be some part of your range at some point, basically.
When you say incorrect in the hand you're playing, do you mean sort of after the fact, given
knowledge? Yeah, as in you lose the hand, yeah.
Right, yeah, right. So you call, and then it turns out he has the flush, and then you're like, oh, was I a donkey for calling there? And then you can look in the solver, and it might say, you know, I mean, I guess by the same token, like, it could even say you're just strictly supposed to call there. Like, I mean, that happens in poker all the time, right? You make the right decision. Whether or not it was meant to be a mixed strategy or if it was a pure call, you make the right decision and you get unlucky, not because you get drawn out on, right? That's the form of luck that most people are accustomed to thinking of in poker. But, you know, you get unlucky because you ran into a part of your opponent's range. You know, you say, well, he went all in on the river. He either has quads or a bluff. And he happens to have quads. I mean, like, your analysis could be right. He, like, and it's going to be easier to have a bluff than quads. And, you know, you are supposed to call with some hands that can't be quads in that situation. And so if you run into the quads, it might be that your opponent did have a well-balanced strategy or even would be doing a lot of bluffing in that situation. And you were just unlucky to run into the quads this time.
Yeah, and so I think that is, like, the quads versus air situation is, like, you know, what your opponent has one combo, right? And you beat all the other combos, and so sometimes you got to call there, and it's like, yeah, you're gonna feel terrible calling off, you know, paying the guy off who has quads, but some percentage of the time, you should be making that call.
So this is a good opportunity to talk about how to, like, use game theory in decision making. So let's suppose that, you know, we're playing against an actual opponent. I mean, there's a real person sitting across the table from us, and this person makes a, you know, big all-in bet on the river, and whatever the circumstances are, we determine, like, either he has quads or he's bluffing. Certainly the theoretical play is, like, assuming that you could never have quads yourself, let's just stipulate that, because that would complicate things. But let's just say, given how the hand played out, like, you're never going to have quads, your opponent could have them. So, you know, definitely if you put this into a solver is sometimes going to call with a hand that could beat bluffs but would lose to your opponent's quads. That doesn't necessarily mean that you should do that in real life, right? You have two choices of how to approach this situation. The one is the exploitative approach. So you could just say, based on what I know about this player, do I think that they are going to be either over or under bluffing in this situation? So there is a frequency given the size of the pot and the size of your opponent's bet and the likelihood of your opponent actually having quads. Like, could he have gotten, how often will he get to the river with hands that would give him quads? There is a frequency with which he should be bluffing. Right? He's made a bet of, I mean, to keep the math simple, let's say there's $100 in the pot and he's made a $100 bet. He should have one bluff for every two value bets in that situation. If he's constructing his range perfectly, he should have one bluff for every two value bets. So he kind of has to do a little bit of math in his head, ideally, of here's how often I'm going to have quads, and then here's how I want to balance that bet with bluffs, and then he should bluff at that frequency. So you might be able to predict, now given that this is a real human being, lots of things could happen. It might just be a person that you have experience with, and you feel comfortable saying, you know, we call this guy Nitty Joe for a reason. You don't call Nitty Joe your bets. And so, like, you can just go ahead and fold 100% of the time, even though that's not what a solver would do. A solver doesn't know that it's playing against Nitty Joe. In fact, you can tell a solver that it's playing against Nitty Joe. You know, you can do something called node blocking, where you set a strategy for your opponent. And so if you made Nitty Joe's strategy, like, he only bets with quads and nothing else, then the solver would tell you fold 100% of the time. So then it comes down to how confident are you in making that assumption about Nitty Joe? Are you confident that's who you're playing against? Now, we could flip that around and say, well, you know, we're playing against someone who you think is going to bluff too much in this situation, in which case you might end up calling with some hands the solver wouldn't. You know, or you'd call, again, it's not a mixed strategy for you. You call every single time you have a hand that can beat a bluff because your opponent is going to have that bluff way more often than that 1-to-2 ratio that he's supposed to have. Where game theory really becomes useful is when you don't know what your opponent's strategy is going to be. So you have no idea who this person is sitting across the table from you. You don't have any tells on this person. You're completely lost. You're facing this bet, and like, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do in this situation. A basic knowledge of game theory can help you approximate a strategy. If you could replicate exactly what a solver did and you knew the starting conditions, like you knew your opponent's exact range for getting to this situation, which is itself an assumption. But I mean, if you could put it into a solver with all the necessary prerequisites, you know, a solver could give you a perfect, totally unexploitable solution. You're not usually going to have those requisites, and more importantly, you're not going to have access to a solver while you're actually playing. But understanding game theory can help you figure out, okay, I know I'm supposed to have some hands that call in this situation and also some hands that fold. I mean, this is what I mean when I talk about range construction. Essentially, yeah. You know, I'm thinking about, okay, I know roughly what the solution to the situation looks like. I call sometimes and I fold sometimes. And the frequency with which I call is a function of the pot odds. My opponent is risking $100 to win $100, so I need to call half the time or else his bluffs are going to be profitable. Right? If he wins that wager more than half the time, he shows a profit on his bluffs. that doesn't mean he definitely is bluffing. Like, it might turn out that I'm playing against Nitty Joe and I don't know that. But that's not information that I have at the time. Just like I can't see his cards, you know, I don't necessarily have access to this information about what his actual strategy is. So game theory gives me a structure for thinking about this. And so, okay, so I know that I need to call with about half of my hands that can beat bluffs. And if you really understand game theory, you might even be able to distinguish, you know, that it's not always arbitrary which half of hands you call with. Some might be better than others for calling. There might be certain hands that make it less likely that he's bluffing. But if you have a sense of which hands would he be likely to bluff with, you would prefer not to block those hands when you're calling. So if you think, well, he either has quads or he has a busted flush draw, right? He has either he missed with a hard draw or he has quads. Well, you don't want to have hearts in your hand when you call, because that makes it less likely that he has hearts, and that's what you're hoping for. Right? When you're calling, you're hoping to get hearts, so you don't want to be holding hearts. Conversely, you might think the only way he could have quads is, you know, maybe there's three sevens on the board, and he raised under the gun. So for him to have a seven, it would almost have to be either like ace seven suited or eight seven suited. Those are like the only two sevens.
The only hands he could have, yeah.
So then, like, whatever that seven is, like, what's the missing seven on the board? The seven of diamonds is the one not on the board. So you would like to have either the eight of diamonds or the ace of diamonds in your hand when you call, because then it means if you have the ace of diamonds, he does not have a seven of diamonds. And in working with a solver, what we would see is that if it knew that the only two combinations he could have are a seven and eight seven of diamonds, it would most likely always call when it blocked those. So if it had the ace of diamonds in its hand and it could beat bluffs, it would always call. And then it would always fold if it blocked his flushes. And then there might also be some hands in the middle that it would mix, where it would say, it doesn't really matter whether you call or fold with this. Like, it's sort of going to be the same result. If you call, you're going to win. You're going to have an EV of zero. Right? So you're going to win just often enough to break even. And if you fold, you're going to get bluffed just often enough, again, like your opponent's not actually making money. So there's going to be three different kinds of hands. There can be hands that strictly prefer calling, hands that strictly prefer folding, and hands where you're indifferent at equilibrium. And again, it's your choice whether you choose to pursue an equilibrium strategy or if you want to make a guess about how your opponent is playing. But I think having that knowledge helps me to know, like, if I don't have a lot of, I don't know for sure that I'm playing against Nitty Joe, but I'm playing a guy who, he looks like he could be a Nitty Joe. You know, he's got the,
right,
the demographics are there. You know, so now I have a sense of, okay, I might choose not to call that player with any hand that's a pure bluff catcher, meaning I don't have those magical blockers. I don't have the ace of diamonds. I don't have the eight of diamonds. In theory, I'm probably supposed to call with some hands that don't fit those criteria, but I know that those calls are only zero EV, even if he's constructing his betting range perfectly. The only world where I'd want to call with those hands is if I had reason to believe that he's bluffing too much. And if anything, I think he's probably bluffing too little. So I might choose to just strictly fold all of those hands that a solver tells me are supposed to be a mix. Because what that means is the solver is telling me that I'm indifferent. The calling and folding would have the same EV for me if a solver tells me that it's a mix, assuming my opponent's betting range is truly unknown to me. But I would need more of a read to fold if I had one of those magical blockers. Because now, even if my opponent is slightly underbluffing, the fact that I have this like key piece of hidden information that he doesn't have means I'm not indifferent in equilibrium. Like, calling is strictly better. So my opponent has to be making not just a small mistake in his range construction, he has to be making a large mistake in his range construction for me to go from strictly preferring a call, as I would at equilibrium, to strictly preferring a fold. It would require me to make a bigger assumption about my
So I think you are getting at what people actually have trouble with when they learn about the idea of equilibrium and range construction, which is the mental translation from I call to I'm going to call 45% of the time, particularly in live poker. I think it's a little bit easier when you're playing online to make that transition. Like, I know that when I'm playing, like, I have a hard time of like, yeah, like, okay, I want to check on monotone flops like 80% of the time, but like, do I want to check on monotone flops with this specific hand 80% of the time? So, you know, kind of what are some of your, like, what is your philosophy on introducing frequency, especially like before the river, right? And we'll talk about the difference between Play Optimal Poker 1 and Play Optimal Poker 2 here in a little bit, but especially pre-river. How are some of the ways that you implement like frequency-based decision making, while you're actually playing?
I'll tell you one thing I very rarely do is randomize my actions.
Yeah, RNG.
Right. I mean, I don't literally generate random numbers, and I also don't. I'm not even aspiring to do that. So frequencies in the sense of, like, if I look at a solver and the solver says, oh, when you have a six of clubs, you're supposed to call here 56% of the time and fold 44% of the time. I'm not trying to do, when I'm actually playing, I'm not trying to call 56% and fold 44%. But that's the case where, in the example we just gave against the potentially Nitty Joe, where at equilibrium, it doesn't matter what I do. So I'm, the consequences of guessing in that case are pretty low.
So low.
I'm usually better off trying to guess. Just trying to say, do I think based on my experience in poker and whatever stereotypes I'm comfortable, or, you know, whatever, like, limited reads I might have on this particular opponent, I have a sense of what kinds of things make me indifferent. So we're talking about a simple case of just, like, calling or folding on the river, where it just comes down to what we think his, like, value betting and bluffing frequencies will be. So, you know, I can just ask a simple question, like, does this seem like a spot and a player where I should expect underbluffing or overbluffing? And knowing that that decision, that there would be a mix at equilibrium or according to a solver, means I have a lot of flexibility to just sort of go with the hunch one way or the other. I'm going to be less inclined to go with a hunch when I have a hand that I know a solver would strictly call or strictly fold. Doesn't mean I would never do it. I just would require a stronger read. So I'm not generally trying to randomize when I know that I would be indifferent with a given hand at equilibrium. So I'm not thinking in terms of frequencies.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
The sense in which I am thinking in terms of frequencies is with regard to how I'm going to play my range in a given situation. And this is another, like, mindset shift that I think, I mean, there's really no getting around it. Like, you need to wrap your head around this, but I know that it's something that a lot of people who are, like, new to thinking in these terms, it is hard for them to do. That from your opponent's perspective, you're not playing a single hand. I mean, from your perspective, like, you know what your cards are. Your opponent doesn't know what your cards are. What your opponent does know is all the actions that you've taken. So from your opponent's perspective, what he's playing against is all of the hands you could have given the things you've done so far. And the things you've done so far are not arbitrary, right? Like, when you raise under the gun,
right,
there are reasons why you can't raise deuce seven off under the gun. It's not just like, some people do and some people don't. It's a matter of taste. You know, like, there are good reasons why you don't raise deuce seven under the gun. There's good reasons why you don't call bet with deuce seven on an ace, king, queen flop. So, you know, your actions convey information to your opponent. And there are things you can do to try to reduce that or try to, you know, create some deception. But, I mean, there's no getting around that. When you take actions, you give your opponent information. Hopefully you're getting something in exchange for that, but, you know, you are giving your opponent information. So you want to be aware of what information have I given my opponent so far, and what could he logically deduce about my potential holdings given that information. And that's what we mean when we say playing your range. It means being aware of all of the hands that it could make sense for you to have given the information you've given to your opponent so far. So when I think about frequencies, what I'm really thinking about is roughly how often do I want to call or raise or fold in this situation? A simple example of this would be, I've called a raise from the big blind, and under the gun player raises, I've called the raise from the big blind, and now I'm facing a continuation bet on the flop. So I am going to ask questions like, how large is this continuation bet? And we'll assume, you know, it's kind of trendy now. And I shouldn't say trendy, there's good reasons for it. But, you know, let's say this is just like a pretty small continuation. It's like one third of the pot. So I might not be able to put an exact number. I'm not going to be able to tell you in any given situation, like, the exact frequency with which a pio solver would call. But I am going to be able to tell you that facing a one third pot bet, calling is going to be your most likely action. Right? You're going to call more than you fold. You're going to call more than you raise. And given that we're up against an under-the-gun raiser, we should expect that an under-the-gun raiser has a much stronger range than a big blind caller, especially if we're playing a tournament where there's antes. We have a lot of incentive to call from the big blind. So you should expect that, like, in general, an under-the-gun raiser is going to have a stronger range than a big blind caller. And that means you're also not going to do a whole lot of raising. Even on flops that we might think of as being favorable for the big blind, like a 7-7 deuce flop, we might think, oh, the big blind's more likely to have a 7 than under-the-gun. That's true, and you get to do some raising because of that, but you're not going to do a lot of raising. So if I'm facing a small c-bet on that 7-7 deuce flop, I'm going to say to myself, okay, I know I'm not supposed to fold very often. I'm not supposed to raise very often. So my default play is going to be the call. I have nothing about my cards yet. I'm just saying, like, I know baseline, I'm going to do a lot of calling in this situation. I'm going to do a little bit of raising, probably slightly more folding. If we wanted to put numbers on that, it might be something like 70% calls, 10% raises, 20% folds, or 65, 10, 25, somewhere in that neighborhood. But I'm not trying to get to that level of precision. For me, it really is just sort of like some, a lot, a little, none. Like that's about the level of granularity that I'm thinking. So I know now, okay, I'm most of what I do is going to be calls. And then I'm going to look at my cards. I mean, I've already looked at my cards. I'm going to think about my cards. And I'm going to say, given the two cards that I hold, is there a reason to make an exception to this rule? And, you know, there might be. Maybe I have a 3-5 offsuit, which is sort of an ambitious defend from the big blind. But, you know, it's got no coordination with this board. Nothing about it particularly suggests it's a good bluffing candidate. Even though I know I'm supposed to call a lot, this is probably. And obviously, like, not a lot of people are going to get that one wrong. But there might be a trickier example. Maybe I have queen-jack suited with a backdoor flush draw, and I'm facing this bet. Or we'll say 10-9 suited. So I have a backdoor flush draw and a backdoor straight draw, and I'm facing this really small bet. If you're not doing range construction, if you're just sort of playing your cards, you might look at that and think, well, I've got garbage. I've got 10 high. I've got no straight draw. I've got no flush draw. Obviously, right. From the range construction perspective, or if you're thinking in terms of frequencies, I know I'm supposed to do a lot of calling in this situation. And if my starting point is, I'm only going to continue if I have a pair or a flush draw, or, you know, a draw of some sort. Well, there's no draws to have on 7-7 deuce rainbow, right? I'm like, I'm never going to have a flush draw. I'm never going to have a straight draw. I'm pretty rarely going to have a pair. Like, I mean, you don't get dealt pocket pairs that often. I'm calling a really wide range from the big blind. So if I hold myself to the standard of, you know, you can only call if you have a pair or a draw, I'm not going to be calling most of the time. I'm going to be folding most of the time. And I know that's wrong. So I'm going to have to lower my standards a little bit for what counts as a hand good enough to call or raise. And I'm going to look for things. So first off, I'm going to consider high card hands. You know, like, I'm probably not going to fold ace high on this board. Might not even fold some king highs. And since I can't have straighter flush draws, I'm going to look for backdoor draws. That's why I changed it from queen jack to queen jack. Might be a defend also, but, you know, 10-9 where I've got the backdoor straight draw and the backdoor flush draw. Maybe this is a hand I should be putting money to the pot. Like, if I know I'm supposed to be continuing between calling and raising, you know, I'm going to be continuing with 75-80% of my range. 10-9 suited's not a great hand, but, you know, is it in the bottom 20% of my range on this board? Maybe not. So now I'm thinking, okay, I could either call with it or I could raise with it. They're both reasonable options. I'm not supposed to do a lot of raising in this situation, so, you know, I'm probably going to call. And then you just have to play. So this is one of those examples where, yeah, it's like leaning into the tough decisions. Like, yeah, of course, you call with 10 high, no draw. You're going to have tough decisions on the next street. But I know how to make those, and I'm going to do the same now. So if I call and my opponent bets again on the turn, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to think about my range now, which is different, right? Because I've already folded my weakest hands to his flop bet. I folded about 20% of my weakest hands to his flop bet. So my range is different now on the turn, but I'm going to do the same process. He made another bet. And again, I'm going to say to myself, well, I mean, probably his bet is not huge. If he overbets, it's a different story. But, you know, that's half pot or two-thirds pot. I'm still supposed to call more than I do anything else. And I'm going to do a little bit of raising, but not a lot. And then I'll fold some of my worst hands. And depending on the turn card, 10-9 suited may or may not be one of my worst hands. If the turn is an ace, it's not of my suit, then 10-9 is probably one of my worst hands, and I fold it. If the turn gives me a flush draw, I'm not folding. I might call, I might raise, but I'm not folding. The turn's a 10 or a 9. I'm certainly not folding. Probably calling with X. I know I'm supposed to call more than I'm supposed to raise, and maybe not a hand that's quite strong enough to raise. But yeah, I mean, you sort of have to look at the turn card. I think one of the mistakes people make in this situation is they just sort of assume that turn bet is coming. And so they say, well, I'm not going to be able to call bets on very many turns, so I guess I should just fold the flop. Well, you don't know yet that he's going to bet the turn. I mean, it's not trivial for him to bet again either. He also is not going to, even as an under-the-gun raiser, he's rarely going to have a good hand on 7-7 deuce. I mean, he'll often have better hands than yours, but not hands where he's eager to be putting multiple bets into the pot. So a lot of times when you call that flop with 10-9 suited, you're going to get to see two more cards, not just one. And if you do miss, you know, you can consider bluffing the river. You have other options. It's not just, you know, I'm calling and hoping to run out of straight, or calling and hoping to run out of flush. And the more that you understand, yeah, I mean, just like understanding theory and knowing like how a computer or how a solver would approach this situation, you can try to, not replicating what a solver is doing. I mean, a solver is going to do this with much more precision than I am, but I'm trying to create a version of it that my like the little calculator I carry around in my brain.
Right. And I mean, I think a big part of that conversation, we haven't even really talked about this yet, but like the toy games that are involved in Play Optimal Poker are like the in position player, the player acting last, you know, the player on the button or whatever, is entitled, generally speaking, to to more of the pot, to more of the expected value, just because of playing in position, which again I think is something that people probably knew during the poker boom and stuff, but which is like any sort of poker reading you do now, any podcast you consume, any television show that you watch now, like everyone who is semi-competent in No Limit Hold'em now, and I assume, I know very little about PLO and stuff, but there is perhaps no greater advantage in turn-based card games than playing in position. Is that hypothesis true?
That's an interesting question. I'm inclined to say no, actually.
Okay.
I think when ranges are similar, you'd rather be in position.
Yes.
You know, in the Ace King Queen game where both players are, this is like a hypothetical poker game where you only get one card, it's either an Ace, a King, or a Queen, and you know, there's no hand values don't change. There's no more cards coming. The goal is just to have the bigger card at showdown. So if both players are just dealt a single card from the same deck and they're both equally likely to get any one of those cards, then yes, it's better to be in position. There's an alternate version of this game that I also discuss in the book where one player always gets a king. The other player is randomly dealt either an ace or a queen. If there were no betting, it wouldn't matter. Well, position doesn't matter if there's no betting. But also, these players, I mean, it's a fair game if there's no betting. I mean, there's variance in it. But in the long run, you know, those players are just going to share the pot. Sometimes the one person gets dealt an ace. Sometimes the one person gets dealt a queen and loses. So you know, in the long run, they break it. They both have 50% equity. If we put this in an equity calculator that calculated one card games, we would find out each of these players is going to win the pot half the time if there's no further betting. If there is further betting, the player who can have either the ace or the queen has an advantage, and has nothing to do with position. He has his advantage is exactly the same. His strategy is exactly the same, whether or not he's in position. So I would say probably the more important thing is if there is a player who has a polarized range and a player has a condensed range, and this is a little dependent on like how much money they have behind, but assuming like a decent amount of money yet to bet, having a polarized range is probably the biggest advantage in poker. But the implication of that is that a lot of play on earlier streets revolves around not ending up in that situation in the first place. And position is very useful for all of that. So like position is useful to try to maneuver yourself into situations where you will be the player with the polarized range, to try to avoid situations where you're going to end up holding a condensed range. I guess it's really more of just like, it's a complicated answer to that question. But in a simple toy game, we can create a situation where position is of no relevance and having a polarized range is a huge advantage.
Yeah, which is the idea of being able to act last on the river as like some sort of revolutionary concept. Like, of course, it makes sense to have the most information at that point in the hand, which is I guess really should not be that revolutionary, but is one of the like of things I took away that I am now trying to implement in playing now after reading your book is just like, I mean, this should be very basic, but you know, widening your range on the button or in the cutoff and like just insanely, like not insanely, but really, really tightening up the ranges from under the gun, you know, to the cutoff basically, just because your EV in those hands in which you act last is so much higher, even with the same hands.
Yeah, I think that's, like, as you said, I mean, most people know this at some, like, basically any, like, remotely serious poker player could tell you, like, yeah, of course position is important. But, I mean, I will say in 15-plus years of doing this, like, I continually come to new realizations. Like, oh, position is even more important than I thought it was. It's even more important than that. Like, every year, you know, I have that sort of realization. And, I mean, you're right that it matters on the river. Probably it matters even more before the river. I mean, partly because you're anticipating being in position on the river when you're in position on the flop. But I kind of think about position, it's like a tax. And every time that we make a decision, I extract, if I have position on you, I extract that tax. So if we're on the flop and there's a lot of money behind, meaning that, you know, there's we're going to have to make decisions on the flop and the turn and the river, quite possibly, then that means I get to take that tax three. If it's a multi-way pot and I have tax on, and I have position on three people, then I get to tax three people. So, you know, being, and likewise, if you're out of position, you're paying a tax to three people in a multi-way pot. So, that's one of the ways in which my, like, understanding of it, because like before the river, not only are you getting the informational advantage, but you also get to, you have more control over the size of the pot. Right? So, you know, people talk about this idea of like pot control or checking for pot control. You know, they have a hand they don't want to play a large pot with, and so they check it. And in position, that's generally correct. At a position, it's more complicated because checking does not keep your opponent from betting. Right? If you're in position, mm-hmm. you can check and guarantee, we're gonna see another card now if I check, or we're going to see a showdown if I check. If you're at a position, you don't have that power. I mean, you can deny your opponent the opportunity to raise you, but if you're playing a no-limit game, he can still bet just as much as he was going to raise. I mean, many of your opponents don't do that, so you can sort of like, sometimes people, you can kind of like Jedi mind trick your opponent into not making the pot as large as you don't want him to do. But if you're playing against a tough opponent, you know, checking from out of position does nothing to keep the pot small. Your opponent is still allowed to just bet as much as he wants to, and you know, savvy opponents will recognize spots where an overbet, for instance, might make you uncomfortable. Position enables you to like to take free cards when you want them. It's safer to slow play in position because you can also make the pot larger when you want to. You know, you flop trips, you just call a bet on the flop. If you're out of position, that's dangerous. You call a bet on the flop, you check again on the turn. Now your opponent can check behind. Suddenly we're on the river. You've still got this huge hand and there's almost no money in the pot. You know, that's a bad spot to be in. If you're in position, you just call a flop bet with your trips and your opponent checks to you. Now you can still bet. You know, your opponent doesn't have the final say on whether or not that bet is going into the pot. So yeah, it just helps with everything, no matter what kind of hand you have. Bluffing is more profitable in position. Pot controlling marginal hands is more profitable in position. Value betting is more profitable in position. Everything is better.
I would imagine that that's something you get from your students or when people talk to you about your books or, you know, playing Game Theory Optimal is, you know, the differences between playing these games, you know, GTO like style, right? Like, and doing that in between, you know, oh, it's easier or harder to play online, or I want to play exploitatively online. I want to play GTO online. So I'm kind of just wondering, you know, what you think about that. Do you think it's easier or harder to play in this game theory centric way online or live? My feeling is actually, it's actually probably easier to play exploitatively as like a predominant philosophy online because of your ability to create tags and notes for players, and then also to like literally just have their statistics displayed, like you know, just you know, how tight or how loose they are. There are thousands of stats that you can get cold from heads up displays. So I'm kind of wondering your overall theory on how to switch up, you know, exploitative versus GTO online and in live settings.
I don't think I have a short answer. I mean, I guess that'll surprise no one who's heard me talk.
There should never be short answers to these questions.
It's fine. I'm like tempted to apologize for babbling, but I know when I host a podcast, I'm always like, oh yeah, the more the guest talks, the better. So So first off, I'm rarely trying to play GTO. In the sense of like, I would probably use the term equilibrium, but like I'm rarely trying to like
play equilibrium strategy.
Exactly. Right. I'm rarely trying to do exactly what a solver would do. I'm often thinking in terms of game theory, but that's not locking me into playing, you know, unexploitably or equilibrium or GTO. You know, even when I'm trying to be exploitative, I'm still thinking about game theory. And often, you know, I'll go back and forth in a hand. Like, I might have a sense of how to exploit a player when he's betting on the river, but less of a sense of how to exploit him when he's betting on the flop, or, like, less of a sense of what the right exploit would be in terms of, you know, what should my check-raising range be or something like that. So, like, usually my process is I'll try to, like, think about what I would expect the equilibrium to look like. Like, if, you know, I'll sort of, if I ran this in PioSolver, roughly what might the output look like? You know, that's the sort of thing of, do I mostly call, do I mostly fold, do I mostly raise that I was talking about before. So I'll try to like get a picture of that in my head, and then I'll think about in what ways might I want to deviate that from that. And generally, the stronger the opponent is, the less inclined I'm going to be able to deviate, and the closer I'm going to try to just replicate what I think a solver would do. against weaker opponents who are unknown to me, I still have some senses about sort of like population tendencies. And I know, I mean, it's not random. Even people you've never played with before, they're not random. Like, I still kind of know what people's inputs likely are. You know, I know what received wisdom in poker is. And I know that there are some spots that are harder to balance than others. I mean, we talked about that 7-7 deuce flop. If you haven't really kind of like studied game theory or thought about that situation, I know what a like sloppy response to that situation looks like. So I know that most people fold too much on that flop because people don't understand why you might want to call up a hand like 10-9 suited. There's other boards where it's a lot more intuitive to just like to do about what a solver would do. Like just what an equilibrium strategy would look like is more intuitive. So I have a sense of, you know, what are spots where you don't really have to understand game theory to play them reasonably well, and what are spots where people are likely to make big mistakes if they don't understand game theory, and what are those spots. So if I'm playing live poker, I can often just look at somebody and say, and there are people who surprise you. Like, I coach people who don't fit the demographics of what you might expect a sort of like game theory wizard kind of person to look like. But, you know, I coach people who have bought custom rigs to run PyoSolver simulations on, who are like very amateur poker players. You know, they play 1-2 or 2-5 and they just think it's fun. And so, and you know, this is like the person I have in mind in particular is kind of like, you know, in his 50s, businessman-looking guy. Like, he is a recreational poker player, but you wouldn't think to look at him like, oh, actually, this guy is, like, super game theory knowledgeable, but he is. So, I mean, there are people who break the stereotype. But nonetheless, like, I'm fairly confident just looking at somebody, fairly comfortable looking at somebody and guessing, you know, to a rough approximation, you know, what is this person's level of like poker? Is this a professional poker player? Or is this someone who is sort of like keyed into conversations among professional poker players? Or, you know, is this a recreational poker player? If they are recreational, like how recreational? that kind of thing. So you have access to all that information live. You can look at the person. Maybe you're getting tells. Maybe you're just sort of gathering demographic information from the person, or making guesses based on what they look like. Then you're right. The flip side of that, playing online, is you might have access to notes that you took on that player from a previous occasion, which, well, all this stuff. So the online stuff is like, I think there's an extra layer of unreliability to it. So you're right. You have access to a lot more data if you have history on the player. A lot of times you're not going to have significant history on the person, especially not if you're playing smaller stakes. You know, when you get into higher stakes games, you do kind of play against the same people often, and you might end up with thousands or tens of thousands of hands on them if you're both regulars. I don't think you see that so much in smaller stakes games. So, you know, you're going to have maybe a couple hundred hands on somebody, and even that is like more than you often would if you're playing like $50 fast fold. You might, a lot of those sites are anonymous. Anyway, without a big sample size, the HUD is of limited use. Yeah, you have access to thousands of stats. Most of them are not going to be useful to you. Any stat dealing with the turn and river is not going to be useful to you if you only have a couple hundred hands on somebody. I mean, at best, it might be a very rough approximation. Preflop stats converge very quickly. So if I see that opponent is playing, has a 60% VPIP, and we've only played 50 hands together. All right, 60 is probably not his true VPIP, but it is comfortable to say this player is playing too many hands, even though we've only played 50 hands together. Like, over no hand sample, unless the game is like insanely good, there is no sample of 50 hands where I would have played 60% of the hands that I was dealt in a six-max game. So,
right,
you know, just to see that on somebody, you know, for preflop, because the person has to make a preflop decision every single hand, those stats converge very quickly, and you know, you can make reasonable approximations about their pre-flop play for spots that come up every hand. Now, 3-bet takes a little bit longer to converge because they don't necessarily have an opportunity to 3-bet every hand. They're not going to do it as often. 4-betting takes much longer to converge. It's really a question of how often does this situation come up. The other problem, like pre-flop spots are pretty similar to each other. Once we get to the flop, even to think about something like c-betting, really we'd like to break that down into, are they c-betting in a multi-way pot or heads up? Are they in position or out of position? What was the texture of the flop? And you don't get, I mean, some of those things you can have substats, like you can look at a stat that says in position versus out of position c-betting. You can probably do it for whether or not it's heads up. But all of that is shrinking your sample size again. Right? As you start to get more detailed stats, you're losing sample size. And some of these things, the solvers, I mean, your stats, your HUD just aren't going to be able to incorporate, you know, the stack sizes, the board textures. So it's a very rough sense that, you know, to look and say this player has a c-bet of 80%. Okay, he's probably, like, all things equal, inclined to c-bet a little too much, but that doesn't mean that his true c-betting frequency is 80% or even necessarily close to it in a given situation. Like, if that player raises under the gun and three people have position on him call and then he bets the flop, I'm still going to take that seriously. Even though I have a stat that says he maybe c-bets a little too much, I'm still going to believe he probably has a hand if he's betting into that many people.
Which is, I think all of that mostly makes sense to me. I think one of the issues, well, so I play on a lot of sites where the games are anonymous. So I think one of the things you can do in terms of applying this stuff is use your exploitative strategies to be the population, which is something that, again, the concept of a population is, you know, newer to those of us who came from the poker boom. And, you know, there are a lot of very good videos out there, you know, explaining mistakes that population at, you know, 50 no limit, 200 no limit, 500 no limit, that these are exploitative mistakes that people are making. And I think a really good thing you can do in your studying and your thinking about your play is, what are common traits amongst my opponents? What is the population likely to be doing that, not even bad, but just off equilibrium? Like, are these guys, are they only shoving on the river with, you know, nutted hands? Are they folding on the turn to overbet way too often? Are they not registering the importance of blockers? And I think even if you don't know your specific opponents, or as you were talking about, you know, not having a full sample of hands with your opponents online, I think you can largely make good inferences based off of what the player pool as a whole are doing wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's very important. I think it's where most exploitative play comes from. Like, it's not really based on experience with a particular player. It's based on experience with the population. I think that's not really specific to online, though. In fact, I think live, you can do more of that. I mean, you don't have the data to back it up, but what you do have is, because there's really multiple populations. So you might, like, if you're just taking a data-based approach to that, and you're saying, okay, well, I have this, you know, maybe you have hundreds of thousands of hands of, like, fast fold 50 NL, and you can do, like, big population analysis of that. But, you know, you're not playing against a random member of the population. If you can look and see this player has a 60% VPIP, that tells you something about him. And, like, the population VPIP is 24% and this player's a 60, right? So that's telling you something about this player, and it contains clues to how he's going to play a number of other situations. But you might, I mean, if you're first hand against someone, you don't know that he has a 60% VPIP. So you don't have this information that he's an outlier. When you play live poker, you know, I have a sense that, like, if I go to a WSOP circuit event, you know, there's a couple different, I mean, even all these have subpopulations, but there's going to be, like, there's traveling pros, there are, like, top flight pros who, like, happen to be at the tournament, but aren't necessarily, like, traveling the whole WSOP circuit, and maybe are even, like, typically playing higher stakes stuff, and this just happened to be a convenient tournament for them. There's going to be sort of, like, local recreational players, and there's going to be traveling recreational players who are generally more serious than local. Right, the local recs are just like, they just want a satellite or whatever, and they're playing the tournament. Traveling people are people who are serious enough about their poker that they, like, came from another area in order to play this tournament. They're generally a little bit better. And oftentimes, you know, you don't have to have a single hand's worth of history with someone. I mean, if it's in the case of a pro, you might just recognize who the person is. In the case of a local player, you might get a sense of, you know, who is this person talking to? Who are they hanging out with? Do they have... like, the last WSOP circuit event I played was in North Carolina. So, like, there's a regional accent. And if someone has that regional accent, they're probably a local recreational player. If they don't have that regional accent, but they're, you know, they look like a recreational player, then they're probably a recreational player who traveled to this event. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. The population reads are super important. It's where most exploits come from. But I think you have more information.
Yeah, I think that is. I think that's likely to be true. Okay, so we should talk about the book. We should tell people why they should read the book, how you want people to read the book. I guess first, you know,
despite.
So I think we should talk about Play Optimal Poker and Play Optimal Poker 2 and how people should read the books. Play Optimal Poker 1 is on, it's on huge sale on Amazon, right? It's like 75% off now.
67% off. Yeah. So
67%.
The list price is $29.99. It's currently available for $9.99. So
there we go.
Definitely, if you're like on the fence, this is the time to pick it up. I guess the main thing I'd want to say to people is, I imagine there's some folks who have been listening to me talk for the last hour, and some of it has kind of like gone over their heads or seemed very like intimidating. And I will say you should definitely start with, I mean, maybe this is obvious, like start with Play Optimal Poker 1. All right, read the first one before you read the sequel. Start with Play Optimal Poker 1. And that really is like a much more gentle, like I kind of dove into the deep end here in this interview. It's a much more gentle introduction into like the overall, like what game theory is, what that means. I threw around the term equilibrium today without ever really like explaining or defining it. There's an entire chapter on Play Optimal Poker that's designed to like explain and introduce the concept of equilibrium. That book really, I mean, the subtitle for the first book is Game Theory for Every Poker Player. And it really is meant to be like a gentle introduction for people. I mean, you need basic poker knowledge. You should know the rules of No Limit Hold'em. You should know how you know how betting works. Honestly, like the more, I kind of try to address what I think are like common misunderstandings, like the, you know, see betting too much sort of thing, like common received wisdom. So, you know, like maybe you have some of that background of like, you have a sense of what sort of like, being people use that term ABC poker, which I don't like that term, but I know it's a common term. So you have a sense of sort of like what ABC poker strategy looks like. You know, that's actually, in some cases, I'm arguing against that in the book, but that's really about all the background that you need for the book. You know, I try to explain the stuff. I do the math for you. There's not a lot of math. It's not important that you understand the mathematical details. The important thing is just to understand the concepts, right? All you don't have to be doing it at nearly the level of analysis that I'm doing. You even just understanding the basic concepts is going to be useful to you. And the most important first steps, like the you're probably familiar with like the 80-20 rule, right? You get 80% of the results with 20% of the effort. The 20% of the effort is just understanding the concepts, right? Then you know, to go, like if you want to play in higher stakes games, like the details do matter, right? I mean, if you're trying to play in big games, the details matter. But for, you know, the 99.9% of poker players, just understanding these concepts is going to be enough to be like a quantum leap in how you're currently thinking about.
Yeah. So I would say that from reading Play Optimal Poker, and I'm about 35% of the way through Play Optimal Poker to have had four authors to interview this week. So it's been a busy week of reading books, but my advertisement would just be that I was like at best like a person who could like not get killed at you know at 1-2, 1-3, 2-5 you know live games at casinos in the Midwestern United States, and I certainly feel much more competent, much more like the ability to assess what's actually happened in terms of like expected value and who has the equity in hands, you know, simply from reading the book, but also the ability to understand when high level players are talking about the game, like actually understand what they're saying instead of sort of just nodding along. So that is my endorsement of your books, which I think is a good endorsement.
Yeah, I take that as high praise because you impressed me over the course of this conversation with sort of the cogency of your questions. I sort of just reading between the lines, it sounded like you knew what you were talking about. So if your knowledge came largely from my book, I'm flattered.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, your books are the ones that I've read that I've enjoyed the most. So what is the best way for people to purchase your books? How does the most money end up getting in your pocket? But I always ask authors this, where they want people to purchase their books from.
I appreciate that. I do have that site, knitcast.com. I get a slightly larger percentage of the sale if you get it through knitcast.com, but I think it's actually better for me if you buy it from Amazon. And
give it a 5-star review.
Yeah. So yeah, reviews are honestly like, I mean, of course I prefer 5-star reviews, just like reviews in general are so, like that really is the best thing for me. If you get it through Amazon, I understand some people have, you know, objections to Amazon's various business practices. So, you know, like there is an option if you don't want to get it through Amazon. If you want a paper book, you have to do it through Amazon. Ebook. The other advantage of going through Amazon is, you know, if you have a Kindle, it gets like was that like magically delivered to your Kindle? I don't have a way of doing that. So you, if you buy it from me, you have to download and transfer it to your Kindle yourself. The main advantage of buying it from Nickcast is if you want an ebook version that's not Kindle. So if you want an EPUB, which you can read on other e-readers besides Kindle, or if you want a PDF, the only place to get that is from Nickcast.com. But overall, like, I mean, the difference is very small for me. So I would like people to just do whatever is most convenient for them. And buying from Amazon is sort of like, it's good for my sales rank. It's, you know, if you leave a review, that's very helpful. But yeah, honestly, just like do what's convenient for you. The difference for me.
All right, everyone, read the book and follow Andrew on Twitter at Thinking Poker. Andrew also does a weekly show with Nate Mavis, and I actually haven't even been listening to the show long enough to know what Nate's job or role in poker is, but I really enjoy the show. I've actually found the Thinking Poker podcast to be a good quarantine listen, in the sense of like you can listen to an episode from 2 years ago and be entertained and pull things from it. So I would encourage people to listen to that show as well. And yeah, Andrew, thank you very much for joining the show.
Thank you. Yes, great questions. It's a pleasure talking to you.